Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a fortnightly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And this week we've got with us James Bennett, who's a long-time Django contributor, been on the Django board and, you know, well, you know, all-round hero of mine. James, thank you for coming on. It's really...
Hello, thanks for having me on.
Massive honour to have you. We always talk about, to start off with, like, people's backstory and how they got into programming, how they got into Django and all the rest. But am I right in thinking that you did philosophy? Because I did philosophy.
Yes.
But you bailed. You didn't get a PhD like Carlton. You quit early.
I was trying to. I was a terrible student. So I did not get into a PhD program.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So I was growing up. My family didn't have a lot. I didn't actually have a computer at all. I had a little bit of experience with an Apple II at school.
Okay.
But it wasn't until I went off to college that I had reliable access to a computer and to the internet. I didn't have my own computer until my second year. And I was taking courses. It was a small college, and so it was a department not just of philosophy, but a combined department of religion, philosophy, theology.
Okay.
And I was taking a course on ancient Hellenistic religions.
Nice.
Ring a bell, Carlton?
No, I never did that.
The professor was kind of a geek, and at the end of the course gave us an option. You could either write a 15-page research paper on an assigned topic or produce a website with 5 pages.
That's easy.
And I was a lazy student.
Yeah, good programmer.
So I learned a little bit of HTML, made a website, and kind of was interested, decided to start learning a little more, learned some HTML, some CSS, some JavaScript. I was working as sort of a department assistant. I was the guy who would go, like, when they needed something from the library, I would go pick it up for them, or they needed copies made of things. And my advisor found out that I'd learned how to do this and was like, hey, our department's website could use a little refresh. Would you like to do that? And we'll pay you for it. And so I did. And then I did his personal faculty page for him. And that was kind of the start. I spent a summer when I was supposed to be doing much more research than I actually did, learning PHP and a couple other things. Built my own, like, personal blog engine. And then I graduated, applied to some PhD programs, didn't get into any, got kind of a boring job at an insurance company and saved up a little money, and then went into business with a friend of mine who was a designer. Because you could do that. This was like 2004, 2005. You know, you could do that back then. You could just say, I'm going to go into web stuff, and it would work. And started doing contract work, mostly PHP and Perl. And I was learning Ruby and Rails shortly after that came out. I'd bought the Rails book. I had learned Python from reading Dive into Python by Mark Pilgrim. But at the time, Python web development was basically Zope.
Right, yeah.
And where I was living in Virginia, there were people around me, like there were user groups that I could go to for tech stuff that some of them did Python, but they all did government contracting. So like U.S. federal government websites with Zope and like hugely complex requirements and everything. And then one day this thing called Django came out. And I read about it. I decided to play with it, and I really liked it. And I remember I wrote something on my blog, not the one that I have now, but an older one that thankfully is gone, about how I really like this Django thing, and I really wish one of my clients would let me use it. And I kind of joked about maybe I should go on strike until somebody says I can use Django. And a little while after that, I got a message from Jacob Kaplan Moss saying, hey, the journal world is hiring. Would you like to apply?
Fantastic.
And so I did. Flew out to Kansas, interviewed with them. They decided to hire me. And so I moved out there, and that started my like proper Django.
So that's
career.
Right in the crucible. That's like, you know, you're there at the.
Yeah. So one fun thing, that little website that I did for that course, thankfully that also is not online anymore, but for a long time it was, and because it was on a .edu domain, I kept getting email from people assuming I was an academic expert on the topic and being like, "Yo, I've been reading this. Can you offer any, you know, follow-ups, anything else that I should study?"
Because you were like the webmaster address at the bottom.
Yeah, I was not a professor when I did that. I never am going to be. I was a student who was lazy and trying to avoid writing a 15-page paper.
So is it fair to say that programming seemed to fit your mind, though? I mean, I don't hear quite the same struggle that other people seem to have, like learning multiple languages. It seems like it, you know, you obviously had to do the work, but it made a sense to your mind how programming works.
Python did. Python has always fit my brain. PHP and Perl, I had to put in some work. JavaScript, I had to put in some work. HTML kind of clicked easily, but that was the age of VueSource.
Learn how to do that anymore now.
I mean, it's also that I just had, thankfully, because I was doing it over a summer when I had not many other responsibilities, I had the time to just kind of like bang my head against it. Like, my first little PHP blogging application was not good, but I was very proud of it.
Yeah. Well, that's always how it is, right? I mean, I was telling someone the other day, like, you look at code from a year ago that, you know, someone else wrote, let alone you wrote, and generally you're like, ugh.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just how it goes.
Yeah. And yeah, like I said, Python kind of fit my brain. Like, PHP, I give a lot of credit to PHP for making web programming so accessible to so many people. Mm-hmm. Like, at that point in history, because up to then, it was basically you had to learn CGI, which is kind of a complex and tricky programming model, and probably you had to do Perl, which has its own quirks and is kind of complex to learn at first. And PHP made that so much easier, because it was just write this, and you know, you can intersperse a little logic with some HTML and just upload it, and it works.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's that quote about solve the web problem quickly. That was its kind of goal.
Yeah.
And I still hold that in my mind, you know, as you know, whenever I'm thinking about Django and what's good about Django and what the strong points, try and hold that, you know, Python still hasn't got the deployment story of just stick it up there and it'll work. But
yeah,
that solve the web problem quickly, I kind of think that that's something that Django has going for it,
yeah,
as well.
We never had the kind of like mod PHP of just upload some files in a directory and your web server will run them for you.
No, we didn't. But that general goal, I still hold it. And you know, when you say you give credit to PHP, it's exactly right. It's like, you know, how did I get in? I picked up the PHP and MySQL programming book.
And if PHP had not made it that easy, I don't know if I'd be here.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things I've always been impressed by, James, that you've stayed so involved in Django itself, both on the technical side and also the community side. I mean, this is true. I mean, when I joined the Django Software Foundation, you were on there. You were also actively involved with the technical things, and you actually drove the development, I believe, of the technical board, in part because, you know, you were, I think, the person. You were involved. You had your hands in everything.
So the technical board was Jacob and Adrian, and I want to pause and give them a ton of credit, because they set a really great example and they did some great things for Django. I mean, from the very beginning, with opening up to other people, being given commit access, to then stepping back, like, one of the biggest milestones and potential problems for a project or a community like Django is whether it can survive the loss or the moving on of its founders.
Yeah.
And they set it up to succeed at that. And then they stepped back and they said, we don't need to run this for the rest of our lives. And then we got the technical board. You know, we still had at that point the technical board and the committers, the core team. as the decision makers, but they deserve a lot of credit for that because they set Django up to succeed and be hopefully sustainable in the long term. Because like there are other projects that never really get over like their founder or their kind of like old guard team and just kind of cling to that for as long as they can.
But part of that is being open to I remember when they stepped back and it was, you know, BDFL, but BDFL until we stepped down and then what's going to happen now? But Django's had quite a big contributor base and was historically open to new contributors. And you know, is that cultural or
I think they did a lot to encourage that. They were very open to feedback. Even before Django was publicly released, they were kind of showing it around to people and asking opinions. You can hear stories of like Ian Bicking being asked about the thing that became Django and offering his opinions on it, and kind of, you know, the ORM used to be a code generator, and there was feedback to, yeah, maybe don't do that. Like, yeah, I think they really set the tone for that by being open to feedback, to other people jumping in and helping out, and being willing to not be gatekeepers of Django forever, but saying, oh, this person's doing good work, let's give them a commit bit.
Yeah. And one thing I've always liked is the approach for consensus, looking for consensus, in that, you know, it's like, well, you know, actually there's not a consensus for agreement, so we'll just hold off here, or we'll carry on the discussion until we see if we can find that. I think that, you know, it's a real strength. It's not just one person going, oh, I think
I know people get frustrated because it seems like it can take forever to get something done in Django, but I do feel like Django's kind of slow and steady approach to, we want that, but we'd rather have the right version of it than have a version of it right now.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's the other day I was commenting on the channels repo about, you know, the development slow, and it's been slow the last couple of years, but it's inexorable, you know, year after year, it slowly moves forward. And, you know, one way to speed it up is, you know, I'd say one way to speed that up is to join in, but, you know, the reality is that Django's a slow moving beast, you know?
And I think it's also been a benefit in a way, because Django has maintained a lot of integrity of what Django feels like, despite all the changes that have happened. When I did my ORM tutorials at DjangoCon, I mentioned this, I would take like the actual blog model that's used on the Django project, weblog, and go through different stages in its history and be like, doesn't this look awfully familiar every single time?
Yeah. Okay. Nice.
And I think that's contributed a lot. The kind of pace and the kind of, well, let's do it right, even if it takes a little bit longer, has helped Django maintain that integrity over time of, this feels like Django, even as new features get added, even as things get rewritten.
Well, that's even, I was thinking about that today, because Black, the Python formatter, just got out of beta, and DEP 8 has been around and approved, so that, you know, once that milestone was reached. So you could say, well, another framework could have thrown Black in earlier, but, you know, there was a process, there were all these extra steps, people committed to that process, and it will be in there. And when it's done the right way, people can see the discussion, you know. So I think, as you said, taking a little bit longer, having a process wins out in the end, even, and people can always just use it themselves too. I mean, that's the thing with the ecosystem and third-party packages, channels.
Yeah.
There's like an off-ramp for, oh, I really want to do this. And Django, so that frustration always has an avenue.
Yeah, and Django has always kind of encouraged doing things third-party to begin with and building consensus in the community around, yeah, this is a good implementation, this is a good way to do it, and then bring it into Django.
Yeah.
So that happened with migrations, that happened with channels, you know.
Yeah, ASCII stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
And even the. Go ahead, Carl.
Go on, Will. You will.
Well, I want to hear you two talk about the technical part. I was going to say, even just the community part, the DSF, you know, that we had Anna on last week, who's the current president, and she's been on the board for 5 years. And I've been on now 3 years, and there's a natural cycling of people on the board, but there is the sort of passion and knowledge hopefully gets passed along. I mean, you were secretary, James. It's you can't assume that someone is going to volunteer for 10 years on the board or as a core committer, though you've managed to do it a long time, James. So there's a healthiness in terms of having that model and, you know, do what you can. When you have to step away, you can. And that keeps the goodwill in the community. Right. I mean, I know for you, right, like you had a whole spike of work stuff on top of all the Django things you were doing a couple years back, which made you need to step away. But, you know, you're still here you are, right? You haven't rage quit, hopefully. So,
well, I've reduced like Mark. My involvement a lot. I used to be on the DSF board. I served some terms on the technical board. I used to be a lot more active on the developers list. These days, the only thing I really do in the Django project is I'm still on the security team and not super active there, but every once in a while I'll jump in.
Timely input, review something. Timely input, I'd call it. You know, like, you know.
I hope so. So, but yeah, I think that, again, that's kind of the project and the community are healthy enough at the moment. And I think, again, that goes back to like Jacob and Adrian setting things up that way. But they're healthy enough at the moment that people can step back and other people are stepping up to do things.
I mean, we've got to hope that you can step back because, like, you know, I mean, open source and burnout go hand to hand, like, you know.
Yeah.
Coffee.
Like,
and
I wasn't quite intending to have like the mic drop of the new governance and then, all right, I'm out. But
so you mentioned the governance. So that was the abolition of the old Django core and then moving the governance of the framework to the DSF membership. The rebranding of roles, so there's mergers and committers, mergers and releases and roles like this, and then the technical board taking that role, that was DEP 10, right?
Yeah.
One thing that I was worried about, and that, I've got you here, was that the kind of knowledge base, the sort of old knowledge, the old, you know, the established knowledge, to sort of just disappearing as, you know, I looked through the old list of the core committers and they were all like all the people that built all the features. And if they're not there anymore, I was just worried that we'd lose that kind of tribal knowledge slightly. I wonder what you think now.
I feel like people are still willing to like answer questions. I've joked with Russell Keith McGee a couple times that my role in Django now is to be a grumpy old man who remembers what happened.
Yeah. Why is this the case?
That way. And you know, every once in a while, just jump in. But at the same time, there are plenty of other people filling that role. Like I saw, Tim just recently in...
Tim Graham,
in thread about email configuration, jumped in with, well, here's this old ticket, and it never really got anywhere, and here's some thoughts from when that happened. So yeah, there are other people stepping up, and like Carlton, you know, you've been around long enough that you have a lot of that context now.
You've seen the last few years doing the fellow role, like so basically to live in track. That's where I've, you know, deepened my knowledge massively. So, okay, I was working on REST framework and then, but to come in and have to go through track and when an issue report comes in and have to find the history and exactly why it was. And, you know, you do that for a while and it's like, okay, yeah, I can, my knowledge,
you
know, Tim's knowledge of the issues is amazing.
Can't anymore. It's just impossible now, but I used to like 10 years ago or more, I used to every once in a while just go through every open ticket in Django's track and read all of them, see if any of them could be closed, see if any of them needed to be bumped. Like, is there anything like any easy like documentation tickets or things that can be promoted as let's get this one done for the next release?
Yeah.
You can't really do that anymore, but you develop that feel for what's out there, what's open. It's like, oh yeah, I remember there was a ticket about that.
Yeah, and you could try and find it, and that works. Yeah. And then but just the other day, Claude, there was a discussion on about what was it? I can't remember the exact details, but Claude was like, are you talking about this ticket? And there's, you know, a 10-year-old ticket. And I'm like, yes, Claude, thank you. That was the exact ticket I need to find. So, yeah, I mean, so I guess the history is still there. And what's interesting, you talk about Jacob and Adrian, you see a 10-year-old discussion or a 12-year-old discussion or a 15-year-old discussion where they're, you know, handling it in a very gracious and open way. And it's exactly right. Super.
James, another thing I wanted to ask you about is you have given a lot of conference talks over the years that, I mean, that's how I first knew about you, is seeing these talks. And I wonder if I could ask you about, so this was from PyCon 2014, Django the Good Parts.
Okay.
I don't know if you recall your thoughts there, but I thought that was a really
interesting one. And
yeah, but that idea, I mean, there was, you know, Java, I guess that was when, what's his name? There was JavaScript, the good parts, right? That was the thing. But it is, one of my favorite talks is Jacob's from, I think, PyCon 2017, which is a 3-hour build your own web framework, where he basically goes through, these are the decisions you make. And, you know, do you write your own templating language? Do you use something else? And what do you use for the web server? And it sort of distills a top architect level view of these things. And anyways, if you recall that, you know, the good parts talk, I watched that a couple years ago, and it might be interesting to see if it still holds up 8 years later.
So let's see. I have.
We'll put the slides in the notes if they're. I'm sure they're up somewhere.
Yeah, they're somewhere. I'm sure they're online. So let's see. What did I suggest? HTTP abstractions, the request response cycle, the slow and steady approach to features, and apps as the good parts of Django. I'm sure there are more good parts. Those are just kind of the ones that I focused on. I think that still holds up. Like, I think Django's, you know, request response cycle and HTTP abstractions are still quite good, especially, and this was in comparison to doing like your own raw WSGI type programming. And for people who've never done that, like WSGI is kind of CGI adapted to be a Python thing. Like it is literally the CGI programming model, just kind of lightly adapted for Python. So there's all this, like, the way, for people who've never done CGI, the way that it worked was you would have your script and the server would put information about the incoming request into environment variables and the body of the request into the standard input stream, because it was a Unix programming model, and then start your script. And then you would do your processing and send your response, you know, headers and response body out on the standard output stream. And so you had to do all of that processing in the script of knowing, you know, which magic environment variables have which things and how am I supposed to parse them and how am I supposed to handle them. And WSGI is similar in that it passes you a dictionary of the environment. And the keys, in fact, in that dictionary match up to the traditional CGI variable names. And then, you know, you return. And WSGI is a little more composable, but every single step, like if you have, you know, one WSGI app wrapping another, both of them have to parse that environment dictionary. Like the response API is kind of complicated because you have like this thing that you call to start the response and then you return the response. And so I really do think that Django's abstractions are pretty good.
I think there's evidence for that with the move to ASCII as well, because it was, Andrew did an amazing job and it he was just able to, not just able, I don't know just about it. He was able to bring in an ASCII request that maps kind of parallel to the WSGI request. And inside of that, beyond that request object, kind of the insides of Django were like, yeah, I don't even notice. It's, you know.
Yeah.
So we've able to put in a totally different request handling sort of application layer. And Django's untouched virtually.
Yeah.
Virtually.
Well, we had Carl Mayer on from Instagram on the podcast, and I think he said pretty much the only part that hasn't been rewritten by Meta, Facebook, is that very part of Django, and they thought they would never probably swap that out because they didn't need to, whereas they changed the ORM and, you know, everything else. But that bit was pretty rock solid.
I mean, there definitely are other like libraries and frameworks that provide the request response abstraction as objects in a similar way. I just think that Django, that's one of the things that Django got right. And I'm sure there are other good implementations, but I think Django's is really good too. We talked about like the slow approach to features. So I think that still holds up. Apps, absolutely. I've been a fan of Django apps. Like I gave a talk at the very first DjangoCon, which was 2008 and hosted at Google, about like designing what I thought were good Django apps. And I've talked about that a lot before and since, that the app abstraction of you can build sort of a self-contained unit of functionality and then compose and reuse. So things like you can build a contact form, you can build a blog, you can build like all of these different types of features and functionality and compose them together to build a Django site. And I think that's really, really crucial, because just providing that abstraction at the level of not like a database model or a view, but at the level of a whole interconnected unit of functionality for a website has been really, really crucial to Django's success, because it gives you that level to think about, and it gives you the ability to package those things up and distribute them, or even if they're internal, you know, reuse them across different projects. And saves you a lot of time, makes it a lot easier to reason about these things. And so I've always felt like apps were kind of like the secret weapon that made Django so good.
I should mention, you have a Django contact form app, among several others, that folks should check out.
I need to do the Django 4.0 updates. And I got I think it was Marius, pinged me to point out that... the new form rendering is actually going to require me to do some work with the contact form, because the contact form already had a method that uses the same name as what was added for the new form rendering.
Carlton, I know you had a question, but I just wanted to...
Go on, Kevin.
Well, I just wanted to say something quick, which is that apps, people who are new to Django, so especially people coming from another framework, apps is actually something that trips them up, or they're a little not angry about, but they kind of like, oh, this is stupid. Why does Django have apps? I want it to be a certain way. And I see this various discussions. It's like, well, the whole point is you can do it however you want. You can have one app for your entire site, or you can rely on abstraction, and then you can also rely on these third parties. But that concept, maybe it's coming from different frameworks, but that's something that someone coming from another web framework, I find, trips them up initially.
Yeah.
Because there's confusion over what it means.
Yeah, it is a thing that I've had to teach and I've had to explain like at a few different companies with people coming from other stacks, and their assumption is, oh, the app is the thing you deploy. And
projects versus apps. Yeah.
And explaining, you know, like the project is the minimum deployable unit of Django. But, you know, the app is kind of the atomic unit of functionality.
The question is, well, where do you draw the line? It's like, well, there's guidelines,
yeah.
But that's, so I think that's, you know, that's the piece that is unsettling to those folks. It's like, okay, but how?
Yeah.
And yeah.
And it is, it can be tricky. And like, I'm not going to say that I always do it right. It's not something that there is a single rule you can follow that always gives you the right answer.
Right. Well, that's kind of what I tell these people, is say, well, yeah, maybe it's an extra step or thing to think about, but Django, on that balance of customizable, Django is actually quite customizable considering it has guardrails. And that comes at the cost of the apps and some other configs, where it could be Rails, it could just go boom one way, but it makes it easier to be malleable within the construct.
And it lets you turn things on and off. It lets you have, you know, different configurations of features that you can kind of toggle. I think it also helps that Django that Django itself has that approach. So like the apps in Django Contrib, things like the admin and sessions, that you can see that you are composing these things together.
Right. To just one more. Want. Right. Yeah. Carlton, what were you going to say?
I'll follow on from that. Just one more comment is that people get kind of addicted. And what I've seen as a working Django programmer for many years is you go to a company and they're stuck on the old LTS and it's just about to go end of life. And they're struggling to update because they've got, 30 third party apps and 29 of them aren't really maintained properly. And then they're in a kind of bind. And so over the years, I kind of developed a kind of very conservative approach to taking on a new app. And you've got to be, you must be cautious here. You must check it's properly maintained. That's the counterpoint, I guess, is that you can.
Third party app, you mean, Carlton?
The third party app. If you're going to take on a dependency, and then you find yourself kind of stuck. So I tend not to use the LTS myself, but I asked on Twitter recently, if you use the LTS, why do you use it? And one of the biggest responses was, by the time our third-party apps are updated to be compatible, we go LTS to LTS, and that can serve us better than, trying to
fight. I think also the API compatibility promises that we have now make it a little more... make it a little nicer for a lot of places to go LTS to LTS because, Django itself kind of makes the promise that if you're running on this LTS and you have no deprecation warnings, you can safely upgrade to the next LTS.
Yeah, yeah.
Without having to change your code. Now, you would want to test any third-party stuff you're using. But that gives a very nice upgrade path. And I've dealt with setting up dependency management workflows at several companies and how to keep things up to date, and that is a perennial issue.
Yeah, and I recently updated a project on 1.11 and it was remarkably smooth to get it to 2.2 and then 3.2. And it was just and I didn't bother with the intermediate ones because I run with warnings, clear those up, and that was lovely, to be honest. Much better than the old days.
But it does get complex when you've got, even if you're not using that many like Django apps, you're probably using some number of third-party Python libraries and things off, PyPI, and you need to keep those up to date, even if you're not upgrading Django. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a fun thing to do.
Well, so I wanted to ask you, you wrote a post on How I'm Testing Now from 2020, which is related to this, that I thought was pretty interesting, and testing is something we love to ask practitioners about since there's quite a variety of ways it's done in the wild. So we will link to that article, but I wonder just, again, you've worked at a number of companies using Django. How do you think about, practically speaking, proper testing? What are the tools you like to use in terms of the hierarchy of priorities that you like to see in a code base?
I like to see tests. Like, any tests are better than no tests. I'm not particularly like a test-driven development person. I'm skeptical on most like capital letter methodologies for building and managing software projects.
Like full stack developer?
So I may write something about this in the future. I understand that a lot of these methodologies, there's some essential insight that somebody caught once and then tried to propagate that, but it's the everything else that grows up around it and kind of all the rituals and practices that, because so often the things that make a project successful or not are not really, you can't replicate them to the next team, the next project, the next thing. It's nobody's figured out how to do that yet in software. So I do like tests. I, for my own personal stuff, I write tests. I use Tox as my test runner because typically I'm testing against a bunch of versions of Python and Django for Django apps.
And sounds like Carlton.
Yeah, Tox makes it very easy to manage that matrix of things and keep them running. I prefer the Python Standard Library's unit test module over PyTest. The last two places
that's
I've
interesting.
Worked have
yeah.
been PyTest shops, but I prefer the unit test module.
Can I ask why that is? Like, what is, because PyTest is very popular now, and you know we still use unit tests for Django's own test suite. But what are your own reasons for favoring that?
So I mentioned this a little bit in the blog post that I understand, or at least I think I understand, what PyTest is trying to do with separation of concerns in testing, and how it wants that. I'm not the biggest fan of dependency injection in Python. And the particular way PyTest does it, I just feel like I kind of struggle with it, because I feel like fixtures can be getting injected and found and loaded from so many different places that it's hard for me to know what's available. Wait, where did that one come from? What does that one do? I have a harder time reasoning about everything that's going on versus like a unit test style where everything is right there on that class and I can see all the things it's doing. Or if it's from a parent class, I can see what it inherited from and I can follow the import chain.
It's a bit like function-based views versus class-based views. Like Carlton, I saw there's, you know, you were waiting to Twitter. Someone had I glanced from a distance and said, braver than I am. It's just
I like class-based views. I think Django's built-in ones could have been done differently, but I understand why they were done the way they were. But in general, I'm a fan.
Yeah, I mean, the claim I made was that they give you a namespace to break your logic up in. And I think the issue is that we teach, here's one line and you've got a list view. And that's kind of deeply mysterious. Whereas if we taught, you know, a class with a get handler and then you declare your view, then it's exactly the same as a function-based view at that point. But it's just got a bit more structure if you need to break if you need to break it up. And I think, well, yeah, that was my point, is that, hang on. What are we arguing about here? Are we comparing function-based views to Django's generic class-based views? Or are we comparing...
And I feel like I lived through the entire era of generic function-based views and of that being function-based views being the way you did things in Django. And I remember how much more difficult it was to like add functionality. It's like, okay, now I need another keyword argument and I need another conditional in the body of the function to handle that keyword argument and I need to account for it everywhere. And if you ever go back and look, like maybe link one of the old Django documentation versions with like the argument signatures of the old generic views back when they were functions, like it's a gigantic list of stuff.
See, this is that grumpy old man wisdom that we need on the young folks, Carlton, right?
So, yeah, like, exactly. Like, and yeah, like the class-based, like the generic views in Django right now that are class-based are the way they are because they tried to replicate exactly what the old function-based views could do. Like we wanted the functionality before and after to be the same. And so that's why they were written the way they were. That's why, if you wonder about like choices that seem weird in terms of what's broken out into a mix-in and what's inherited into the... It's because there was a deliberate attempt to preserve exactly the set of options you had with the old ones so that you could just go straight from one to the other.
Well, Carlton, you've mentioned many times, I mean, Tom Christie has Django Vanilla Views, which is perhaps a clean approach at doing it without trying to mimic the old function-based...
Yeah, I mean, the vanilla views, they're sort of, they don't handle all the basic create views and, the form handling views, and then the list and detail. And for those, they kind of, 1.8 time, they were sort of feature equivalent. but there's just a more direct style without the mix-ins. And so I always recommend people, because there's only like four files in that package, I always recommend people to go and read the source code of Django Vanilla Views, because it kind of, it's really eye-opening. It's like, oh yeah, actually, what's going on here is just turning requests into responses, and you know, there's not too much to it. And then you go back to classy class-based views and the Django ones, you know, I see the same thing's happening. And that's a nice learning
experience. At any point, could Django simplify the ones we have? Or feels like there's too much of a compatibility issue.
Yeah, no, not now. No. I mean, our USP is we don't break stuff, right?
Yeah.
And we can't change the generic class-based views that we ship.
I remember when the old form system, or the manipulator system, as it used to be called, and then there was Django.newforms, which became Django.forms years later. So, you know, Django.newgeneric.
Yeah. Oh.
There you go, Carlton.
Okay, if you write the dep, I'll plus one it. How's that?
Okay. I think you're right. There's just too much backwards compatibility, and it's too important a feature to rip out and replace like that.
And it's not that it's bad code. It's great code. It's great code. It's well documented. It's well tested. It's got everything going about it. It's just there's a learning curve, and it's not perhaps as clear as we'd lay out if we started fresh. But
and at this point, it's not clear to people why that learning curve exists, because that complexity is entirely, as you mentioned, due to the desire to maintain exact compatibility with what the old function-based views did.
Yeah. I mean, I think you mentioned that, really, if you're honest, but that's okay.
Well, you mentioned, you know, we don't break compatibility as a policy, that, you know, when the class-based generic views were introduced, they had to be exactly equivalent feature set.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. So, Gormwell, did you want to?
Yeah, I was just going to ask about service layers.
There's a big elephant in the room, which is the ORM, right? So,
the original question about testing, like, it's not that I think PyTest is bad. Like, it's really good. It's really well written, and I do appreciate what it tries to do with separation of concerns. It's just for me personally, it doesn't quite fit my brain, and I find it a little harder to reason about. Like, that's why I prefer the unit test style.
Okay.
Service layers, ORM, pick one.
Well, let's talk about you've taught the ORM, you've contributed to the ORM. Here's a question I'd like to ask ORM contributors. If you've got a young contributor wants to come along and they want to get into contributing to the ORM, how do they approach that? What's the route in to grokking the ORM? Because it's big and scary and multifaceted.
Even Tim said so.
Yeah.
Tim Graham.
Yeah.
He said that was the one area. I was like, where are you not rock solid? And
we've mostly relied on, like, every once in a while. So, like, I'm sure you've heard Russell tell the story of Olis Ndetka when she first started contributing. And picked this really deep, like, gnarly ORM ticket to do that, like, when she submitted the patch, it took Russell and someone else, like, a couple hours with a whiteboard figuring out what was going on and that, yeah, this is the right solution. And she just kind of, like, tossed that off in the course of a sprint. And we've always kind of relied on the kind of genius level. I don't know how she understands the ORM that well.
It's like walking in late to class and, you know, solving the proof that's never been solved right at the MIT.
Yeah. So Django has been very lucky to have people like Ola who just show up every once in a while and can do that. We need to do better with that. Like, the ORM, I would say first try to understand the different abstractions. Like start with, you know, models and managers and query sets, and then, you know, maybe look a little bit at query, look at database backends, look at the like the query object, look at the SQL compiler, like learn to think of, you know, query. I actually think a good analogy is to learn how the template system works and learn how the template system like parses into a tree of nodes and then walks through rendering all of them, because what the ORM does effectively is build a tree of expressions and walk through with a SQL compiler, turning them into SQL. And kind of understanding that pattern and what the major abstractions are. And then you can start reading like some of the scary source code in, you know, query logic. And like, I haven't looked at that in a while, but it is.
So it all comes back to compilers, right? That reminds me, we had Carson Gross who wrote HTMX, and he's a big fan of writing programming language from scratch and teaches them now. And he had some line. He's like, oh yeah, you know, I just wrote a programming language for this problem. It's easier than you think. I was like, for you.
I've been thinking about maybe doing a series of blog posts on like, let's build the Django template language.
Okay.
And just go through like, okay, here's where we're going to parse it. Because the Django template language is incredibly simple. And the implementation is not that hard. Like if you're really motivated, you can probably read through it and work it out yourself. And if not, like a little bit of guidance, I think will get you there. Like just introducing the concepts and what's going on. And then when it all kind of fits together in your head and you understand, oh, that's how it does that. And now you're ready to learn how
the
ORM works.
Plus one to writing that.
I'd read that thread.
Yeah, I've got some things I want to write. I need to decide. I've thought about turning that ORM tutorial into a book, but I don't know if I'm ever going to get around to it.
Oh, Carlton loves when I talk about books with potential guests. Well, you wrote a book.
I did.
I have that. That was, you built a blog in it, I believe, right?
Yeah, there was a blog and I think something else that was built in that one.
Yeah, that was,
I don't know,
back
I
in the day.
A copy of it somewhere.
OG Carlton, as they'd say.
Yeah, OG. See, don't taunt me.
There's just a Twitter thread, you know, just. Yeah,
my children are like, Dad, you have to play more Fortnite because I don't know any slang or any of these street abbreviations.
Am I missing out on things going on Twitter, or am I not missing out by missing out?
No, you're not missing out. It's Will's just teasing me.
Okay.
So following it, okay, so learn the abstractions to get into the ORM. And then recently there was a few articles on using Django or the ORM versus service layers and things. And I think that's really interesting because like why Django, why the ORM, like versus other approaches? I think that's a massively interesting topic. We can link to those blog posts, but it'd be nice to...
We talked about it with some guests back when you wrote it, James, actually. Looked at those, so... Like here's an OG expert out in the wilderness giving an opinion on Django that we want to toss in here.
The ORM more than anything is kind of the sine qua non of Django at this point. It's the thing that if you're not using it, why are you using Django at all? Like the request response abstractions are nice, but there are other libraries that will give you request response abstractions in Python. So basically, it's if you're not using the ORM, why Django at all? Is kind of the question. And I'm not sure the answer at that point is to use Django. Like maybe you want some of the abstractions, you want like the concept of apps, but you want to use another ORM with it, or you're not using a database at all. You know, that can make sense. And you can do the kind of minimal Django. Like, I think some people have even put together examples of how to do a very minimal Django setup.
Yeah, there might even be a talk on it.
But as far as the ORM itself, like putting service layers in front of the ORM, like, the reasons people give for wanting to do this are always you're going to end up reinventing the ORM, or you're going to end up introducing a lot of complexity to make something like sometimes people do it for testability so they can swap out a fake database at during test runs. Some people want to like hide the data access logic and, you know, have separate representations of like business objects and business logic. And there are design patterns for that. Like I mentioned in the blog post several times, like if you really want that, and if you really believe you want, you know, data objects and business objects and explicit logic mapping between them, you want the data mapper pattern and you want to use SQL Alchemy. And you want to use a data mapper ORM. But Django is not a data mapper ORM. It's an active record ORM. And you're trying to take this design pattern that works fundamentally very differently from how Django's ORM works and push it onto Django. And that's not going to go well. And you're going to end up having to rewrite large chunks of the ORM to simulate ORM functionality in your service layer and introduce a whole bunch of complexity. Like, I think in a lot of cases, the problem is, and I touched on this, I think, in the first blog post on that, is people trying to untangle interdependent code. Like these really complex code bases where it's like everything does everything. Like I've worked on code bases where like there were some models that had a policy that you always had to do save with explicit field list because you didn't know what else might be modifying that model at the same time. And so, you know, make sure to only actually save the fields you're changing to the database. And I tried to give what I think are some good guidelines for how to have models as the API of your app and what kind of access from other apps and other code into a set of models to allow. And basically, like, things like you shouldn't ever reach into another app's model and start tweaking its fields directly and saving it. Like don't do that. Instead, you know, expose logical methods. Like the joke that I've used a few times that I've always heard is, you know, if you want to walk the dog, you don't reach down and pick up its leg and put it down and pick up the next leg and put it down. You ask the dog to walk because the dog knows how to walk. And building models that know how to do things rather than having to reach in and grab this field and set it to this and grab this field and set it to this, minimizing the amount of internal structural knowledge you need about those models, because their public API, their list of methods that they expose, gives you the operations you need.
And then at the table level, you might put that on a manager rather than the model itself sort of thing.
Like row level operations on the model, table level operations on the manager class, alternate constructors on the manager class. But yeah, I think that's, it's hard to do. I've advocated for it. I've never seen it completely pulled off successfully. I don't know that I've ever personally managed to completely pull it off successfully, but at least putting in the effort and trying to do it, it gets you a little better results. And then the rest of it was kind of like, well, what do I do with these really complex things? Like, you know, somebody's canceling their subscription and there's like six different models that need to be updated when they cancel their subscription. And it's like, well, if you put that in a service layer, like saying, well, it doesn't make sense for this thing to be on one model. Well, it also doesn't make sense for it to be in one service method because it's doing all these different things. Like that's moving it around while keeping it that complex doesn't actually help. So that's the other kind of issue there. And there are patterns for that, but that's just a matter of like familiarity and experience. And sometimes just going and looking things up, and being like, how do people do this? There are, I think Brandon Rhodes has been trying to do like design patterns for Python, his Python patterns repository. I don't know if he covers like anything other than like the original design patterns book. But there's a lot of stuff out there on how to handle these kinds of like complex cross-cutting concerns in code and how to break it down so that you don't end up with like the one method that does everything and touches everything.
I had one sort of larger question. Is there any more specific ones you had, Carlton?
Just
James?
Yeah, I mean, just on that, I think, you know, that the whole point we made right at the beginning about, you know, doing the web problem quickly. Like the ORM fits that for me. The ORM fits that niche really, really well. And most times, if you're trying to do the web problem quickly, you don't need these extra complex constructions around it. You just need to make sure that as you grow, you maintain hygiene, because yeah, it will get gnarly. It will get intertwined. It will get difficult, but that happens to every project, no matter what architects you use.
So my concluding question is open-ended, which is, so as we record, you're not currently working for a company.
Yeah. I've been given unemployed for just about a week and a half at this point.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Is that home baked bread behind you? I see.
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't make it.
Right. Okay. So win-win.
It is brioche that was homemade. But I was not the one who made it, but I have been enjoying it.
Yeah. Right. Nice.
So my question to you is, what kind of opportunity, given your experience, is interesting? Like, you've worked at small companies, large companies, you've tackled all sorts of web Django problems. What, you know, where you're at now, what kind of things would be interesting? I don't know. Have you managed teams? I feel like you've been more on the code side, but I don't know. Like, what are you looking for? What's interesting now to you?
I've never been a manager. I don't really have interest in being a manager. I've been like sort of climbing the individual contributor ladder. My last job, my official job title was staff software engineer. Like, I put up a blog post about it where I said that I like working someplace where I can use my Django experience and be a resource to a team that perhaps is using Django and Python, but not being defined by it. Being able to do more than just be the Django guy at a particular company. And it's like, it doesn't have to be any single particular thing, but just getting to branch out, getting to learn stuff. Like, I spent the last year, I didn't set out saying, I really want to get good at Docker. And I'm not really good at Docker, but I ended up doing a project that involved learning, you know, quite a bit about Docker, how to do Docker files, Docker compose, orchestrate, you know, Docker based projects. And that was really interesting. And because they were Django services that were being Dockerized, like, there was opportunity to use the Django specific knowledge, but it wasn't just, oh, we've got a Django person, let's have him go do Django things.
I would love to see a blog post on that, by the way, because that's a perennial issue.
Well, I don't know that
the Docker approach for Django.
I don't know that I did it well.
Sometimes it's Kubernetes and it's another.
Like, I did a thing that I thought was okay at the time, and other people are going to pick up and iterate on now that I'm gone. Yeah, it's that's the kind of thing that I look for. Is I don't necessarily know what's going to be interesting to learn, but having the opportunity to branch out and learn other things and do other things that aren't just being defined by Django. Because it is important to me that, like, Django is important to me, and the things I've done with Django are important to me, but it's also important that I'm not one-dimensional. That's not the only thing I can do. That's not the only thing I know. It's not the only thing I can learn.
And do you think that's a IC issue? Because the tech industry isn't great around IC, you know, individual contributors. There's a sense that trees only grow so high, which, you know, I mean, like, other fields don't have that, but in tech, there is a little bit of that.
Yeah. Like, once you specialize in something, it can be hard to be like, you know, people talk about, you know, wanting the kind of T shape of, like, you know, really deep knowledge in one thing and, you know, then kind of okay knowledge in a bunch of other things. But I don't know how many companies actually succeed at that and how many teams actually succeed at wanting that, because getting to a level of specialization with something, you can like it, but that doesn't necessarily mean you want it to be the only thing you do for the rest of your career.
So you're switching to front-end JavaScript development only, right? Is that what you're...
Funny story. Actually, when I was hired at the Journal back in 2006, I believe I was officially hired to be their JavaScript guy. You could see how well that worked out. like at the time I was like, I knew Python, but most of what I did professionally was like a little bit of backend work and then like front end, like HTML, CSS, JavaScript, translating, you know, ideas and designs into actual implementation. And, you know, 2005, 2006 era front end was a whole different thing. But,
well, like, would it be more interesting to be the fifth employee on something with traction where you need to rewrite everything to make it performant, or it'd be more interesting to be the 50th and have to specialize a bit more? I'm sort of curious, you know, where you're at now, which of those two problems would be more interesting?
I don't know. I actually did talk to a company that was hiring for their fourth person and first dedicated backend person. And that sounded really interesting, like the chance to kind of like start from scratch and have a hand in building everything. Like we're programmers. We always love the idea of just starting with that clean sheet of paper and saying, we're going to do it right this time.
This time is different. Yeah.
Yeah. But I've also been talking to places that are much larger and are looking for like someone who can come in and be like a resource and a mentor on Django stuff, but also do other things. And then that seems really good to me. That seems like where I want to be. Like maybe one day I'll do the, you know, first backend person process and start everything from scratch. But I don't think it's going to be this time around.
Well, you could also just consult for equity, you know, with the smaller one, right? Because I feel like a lot of it is somebody who doesn't have the wisdom, who might say, this is how we're thinking about doing it. And in a couple hours, you can save them so much time, but you don't necessarily have to do it yourself.
No, I don't know. I've done contracting. Contracting is expensive. It's expensive to be a contractor in the US, at least.
Expensive for you or for them?
Expensive for the contractor was my experience of doing it, like, because there's so much overhead that people don't think about from being full-time contracting.
Like healthcare.
Yeah, like healthcare, funding your own retirement, you pay more taxes. You pay an extra 15% tax for being a contractor.
I'm self-employed.
Yeah. Yeah. So you know this. So it can be...
Carlton too.
Yeah. It can be tricky.
You said one thing. So I'm going to... You said mention mentoring. So I have one more question I'd like to ask you, and then we'll let you go. But what do you think... It's something that I'm always thinking about. What does it take to mentor somebody well, do you think? The challenge I find is people come and they say, oh, we want to mentor, but they don't bring anything to the table. And how do you find that balance?
I don't know that I have a great answer. In my professional career, like working for companies, I've had a little bit of success getting people from kind of like post-beginner, intermediate into like advanced, intermediate to senior. Working with people who already had some basics under their belt and getting them kind of to the next level there. I've had some success with that. I have never felt particularly great about my ability to start someone like from scratch and get them, you know, zero to at least kind of like a reasonable, like beginner, junior, you know, first job level of knowledge. So I don't know exactly, how to answer that. Like the things that I've been successful with have mostly been like pointing people at resources that are kind of interesting and kind of showing like, here's a pattern that you might not have run into, but we can do that for this thing. Like not necessarily telling them, oh, do it this way, just kind of showing them what options are out there.
Yeah.
And letting them build, because I think that is the kind of, that's one of those things that as far as technical knowledge, as you grow, is kind of your mental library of patterns and possibilities and options that you at least know are out there, even if you don't consider all of them for every single thing you're going to do. And so I've had some success with that, but I don't know how to replicate that necessarily. And I don't feel like I've had great success with people just starting out.
Okay.
The one time I did Google Summer of Code, I was probably a terrible mentor, and I was very lucky because my assigned student was Giannis.
Yeah.
So I got the easy mode.
Yeah, yeah. So Giannis being like Django's second biggest contributor of all time. So,
yeah. Yeah, and like so many other things too.
Yeah.
Like we used to joke that everything you use has been written by him at some point.
More or less, yes. Super. Okay, let's call it there because we run up to time. James, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your opinions.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so we have links to everything in the notes. Check out James's talks if folks haven't seen them already. And we are at Django Chat, Django on Twitter. And we'll see everyone next time.
Join us next time. Bye-bye.